You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Connecting the Dots. I am your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today on this fine Tuesday. I guess this is, you could call this Divine Mercy Week, I suppose. I'm not really sure, actually. Last week was called Bright Week because that's what you call the week after Easter. And the week before that was called Holy Week. So why not call this Divine Mercy Week? That's what I say. It's my story. And I'm sticking to it. Today, we are here today for the last time with Mr. Michael Litchens. Michael doesn't know this because I just found this out yesterday. And so I'm just kind of sharing this each day this week so people will know. But what Breadbox Media has decided to do is... go to a podcast format, which means that we won't be streaming live anymore after this Friday. And so Connecting the Dots will become a podcast that comes out about once a week. And so this is, I am having to bid a fond farewell to all of my co-hosts. I'm sure that we will have Michael on in the future on the podcast, but it won't be since the show won't be a week or won't be a daily show anymore during the week, we'll be kind of bumping around to different co-hosts. So,
can I be Michael, your official reality TV host, please?
Yes, yes, that is sure. We will. Yes, we'll do the podcast from a desert island, or from the International Space Station or something
Let's be honest here. Just a reality TV show about Catholic writers would be entertaining for the first 10 minutes.
No, not even 10 minutes. More like 10 seconds. Watch a fat guy sit in a room.
Who has the longest beard?
Yeah. No, I can't imagine anything more stupefyingly boring, actually, than... It's like the people that, you know, are convinced. I get these things, right? I had somebody today telling me that the FBI needed to investigate my finances because apparently I am on the payroll of someone sinister. And
I wish they'd pay you a little better then.
No kidding. so there it is. FBI, come and get me because you're going to be unconscious from boredom in the first 10 minutes of investigating my finances. I keep saying, where's my damn Soros money that I keep hearing about? George Soros is supposed to be paying all of these people, so how come I'm not getting any? But at any rate, today we have a special guest. Our guest today is Amy Christine Murphy. She is the executive director, and she's the founder of Rehumanize International. You might be familiar with her work previously until they just renamed it. If you've been reading Life Matters Journal, it's the same thing, now called Rehumanize International. After a personal conversion to the cause against abortion as a teenager, she came to support and defend imagine this, a holistic, consistent life ethic of nonviolence during her time at university. During the time of her undergraduate studies, she successfully helped the pro-life organization on campus to facilitate fruitful dialogue surrounding abortion by addressing the ethical foundation of pro-life belief and holistic care for the human person. So the radical notion that human life is sacred from conception to natural death. And so she works with Rehumanize International. She is reaching people all over the globe with a consistent message of human rights, especially as a tool for reaching people through the internet and social media Rehumanize International is succeeding in bringing discourse and meaningful conversation to those who need the message most, our youth. She was the recipient of the Susan B. Anthony List Young Leader Award in 2014 for her trailblazing pro-life leadership. Her life's work is dedicated to infusing all of society with the passion and cause for all of human life through education and discourse, one heart at a time. And she lives in Pittsburgh, PA, with her loving husband and their two dogs. Welcome, Amy Murphy. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you, Mark?
I'm very, very well. I'm so happy to have you on the show.
Yeah, I'm stoked.
Well, I love the work that you do. I've been a fan for years. It astonishes me that Catholics have so much trouble grasping such a simple proposition as life is sacred from conception to natural death. So I'm grateful to you for just, bringing that out. And so I thought I just wanted to have you on the show to just talk about your work and what you've been doing.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, it's my pleasure. It's my passion.
Yeah. You were the one that put me on to, and now I'm blanking on her. I am terrible with names. I've always been terrible with names. She was a guest on the show. I'm ashamed of myself.
Destiny?
Yes, that's it. Destiny Herndon De La Rosa. She was, once the first name is there, I can remember the rest.
Mm-hmm.
You were the one that put me on to her and her epic adventure with the Women's March a couple of months back.
That was an experience.
March organizers shot them. So, well, you know, they're doing it again. Bernie Sanders dared to suggest that perhaps, the consciences of 20% of the Democratic Party, 30% of the Democratic Party, it might be wise to just, respect those people.
Mm-hmm.
And not treat them like garbage. And they thought about that for about 5 minutes, and then they laid down until that feeling went away, and then got up and said, "Knuckle under."
Don't offend the Uber and Nero money, guys. Come on.
One third of their party. Because, we got a real problem. Donald Trump is president. He needs to be defeated. What's the most important thing we could do? The most important thing Democrats can do is
alienate a third of their party.
Is kick out one third of their members over this issue of conscience, right? Yeah. So to talk about how, I gave sort of a brief précis of your life story, but I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you got involved in pro-life work.
Sure. So when I was a teenager, as most teenagers do, they rebel against their parents, right? So I was brought up Catholic, but I didn't really believe any of that by the time I was like 14, 15 years old, right? And so I was in this on-again, off-again relationship at 16. I called myself an atheist, but I was also a feminist because, like, grew up in California. In California, everyone's a feminist.
Right, sure.
Right? It's just, like, how you are. And so Valentine's Day, when I was 16, this on-again, off-again boyfriend raped me and thought I was pregnant, a few months later. And hadn't had a period in forever, and word eventually got to him that I thought I was pregnant. Of course, like, he didn't talk to me. Though we ran in the same circles, our relationship had been strained for a long time, understandably so, right?
Well, yeah.
So eventually he comes and pulls me out of class one day, and he's like, "Amy, you need to get an abortion." And I'm like, "Excuse me?"
Wow.
The thing is, wow. I had been considering abortion up until that moment.
Yeah.
Right. Like, it was totally on the table. I was like comfortable enough with the idea. So I wanted to know his reasoning, and he was like, "Well, I don't want my mom to hear about what happened."
So that was selfless.
Oh my God.
Right. Right. So,
unbelievable.
Then, you know, I'm just kind of like standing there, mouth agape, right? Uh-huh. In the hallway.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, Amy, I just think if you don't get an abortion, I might kill you.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Silence. Like I suddenly everything changed. My paradigm shifted and I understood that I couldn't be like him because what he was saying to me was, you are an inconvenience to my life. You are an inconvenience to my future. Therefore, I'm going to kill you.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
everything just clicked, fell into place. I was like, I can't be like him. I can't use violence to get what I want in life. Who am I to say that same exact thing to an innocent preborn human being?
Wow. Right?
So
what an astonishing grace for you to see that.
Honestly, yes.
You know, I mean, of all the things that could have been derived from that, that you would see that kind of life affirming, loving response is astonishing. God love you.
Truly.
I'm so proud of you. You know, that's fantastic. We'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Amy Christine Murphy and Michael Litchens, and we'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
And welcome back. Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Michael Litchens and Amy Christine Murphy of Rehumanize International. If you want to join the conversation, by the way, you're welcome to do so. Give us a call at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4, and you can ask Amy your own questions if you want. You were telling before the break about this really astonishing, you know, act of grace by the Holy Spirit, that you recognized that the threat against you from your rapist was the same as the threat of violence against the unborn, and you realized you couldn't do that. I'm so proud of you that you saw that, you know, that's just, wow. That's great. So keep going.
Gosh, I mean, that entire movement changed my life. I like to tell people that, you know, that moment forever unsettled me. I can't ever go back to seeing violence as a solution to a crisis. Like even when my own life was threatened, I realized that I couldn't use violence to solve, you know, was this massive problem in a 16-year-old's life.
Right.
You know, we often say, you know, the most passionate people in any given movement are those who have been personally affected by it.
Mm-hmm.
I absolutely agree. And, you know, this is why I say, you know, I've been forever unsettled. I can't go back. And so my job is, you know, at this point, and it has been ever since, to, you know, work to try to unsettle other people. Yeah. And, you know, get them to understand
that, you know, that stands in a very respectable biblical tradition. Now, to be fair, it's, you know, it's worth noting that the people who do that often wind up being beheaded or thrown down wells or crucified. But still.
Sophie Scholl is my hero.
Well, so it's a worthwhile thing to do, you know, and you could do a lot worse than imitate Sophie Scholl, who is, by the way, who is consistently voted by Germans year after year as the greatest German of the 20th century.
Wow.
Yeah. She's a giant. Sorry, Sophie. Yeah, she's great. So I'm sorry. Anyway, keep going.
So after high school, I became the president of the pro-life club at Carnegie Mellon, where like it was just like a anti-abortion group when I joined, which is great and cool. Like there needed to be single issue organizations.
Right.
But the conversation on campus just like wasn't happening. There was just screaming happening constantly surrounding the abortion issue. Like we would host events and people would just come and protest the events. Like they wouldn't come and listen to what we had to say. So, about a year in, I sat down with our board and I said, what can we do to actually have good conversations? And then we ended up talking about like, how do we actually feel about this broad spectrum of life issues? And like, you know, this understanding of respecting, valuing, and protecting the life of every human being from conception to natural death.
Yeah.
And everyone was on board. They were like, well, of course, duh. which is great.
Those terms, it seems reasonable.
We were such a diverse group, you know, like we had atheists and agnostics and Buddhists and Catholics and evangelicals, like we have people from all these different backgrounds working together. And so we changed the consistent life ethic as our underlying moving principle. Of course, we still had tons of events on abortion, but now we also had things on the death penalty and human trafficking and war. And people would come to those events who wouldn't normally come to an event on abortion.
Right.
And, you know, by the end of the talk, they'd be sitting around during the Q&A and they'd be like, so what are you guys about? Like, what's your mission? Why are you here? And we talk about the consistent life ethic. And we, of course, for the next hour, we talk about abortion.
Mm-hmm.
And people were actually engaging in the conversation. And then that's so crucial.
Yes.
Right? Stop putting your fingers in your ears and going, la, 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 I can't hear you.
Yeah.
You know, actually engaging the people where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
So after I graduated, I was like, I'm going to do more of this, and founded Rehumanize International. Of course, it was then known as Life Matters Journal. Mm-hmm. So it's been a wild ride.
Yeah. This is so great. Yeah, it's so, so important. And that's the thing that has consistently astonished me. And I think, to be honest, I think one of the things that you had going for you was your youth.
Mm-hmm.
So that you're actually looking at this from a kind of a perspective of Catholic simplicity. Mm-hmm. In that, yeah. It's human life sacred from conception to natural death. So, of course, you're going to oppose the death penalty. Of course, you know, you oppose unjust war and torturing people and starving them, you know, and denying them a living wage and all the rest of that. And so much of, you know, unfortunately, so much of what's happened to the pro-life movement for my generation is that it's become intensely politicized and it's identified exclusively with one party, and the party that very often defends all those other things is seen as the enemy and therefore must be opposed. And so, yeah, you'll get people. That's the thing that always astonishes me are the people who like, I'm pro-life and I am eagerly in favor of the death penalty. Why? Right? Why
are you doing? Yikes.
Yeah, why are you doing it? Well, because Democrats oppose the death penalty, and so I have to oppose that because I have to oppose them. And it's like, but that's crazy.
At the very least, contrary to an actual consistent understanding of human dignity, but yeah. You know, something I think you talked about youth.
Mm-hmm.
The millennial generation, like the entire millennial generation, is the most politically unaffiliated generation in existence today, and the most non-religious generation. I mean, also like 20% of them are LGBT. Like there's all this different interesting intersection of identity that's happening for millennials. And of course, like I'm part of it. I have my finger on that pulse just because I am one.
Right. Sure.
Right. And so like when we got to talking about politics, like even very early on in our organization, we're like, is there any political party that agrees with this?
No.
No. Yeah. You know, and this back in 2011, and everyone's frustrated with everything, and it's still happening, like in droves. Millennials are leaving political parties. I can't tell you how many of my friends disaffiliated from a political party in the last year.
Oh yeah. Well, who can blame them? You know.
But it has to, like, the entire pro-life movement has to understand, if we want to reach this millennial generation, you have to speak their language.
Right.
You can't be like, oh, you have to vote Republican, when they, like, the millennials understand that neither party is consistent on these issues.
Right.
And I think this comes back to, actually, a desire for authenticity and integrity and, yeah, like, truth. Right.
Yeah.
Right. I just honestly think it comes back to that. I think it's why Bernie Sanders was so popular, and I think it's why Ron Paul was so popular.
Mm-hmm.
Because yeah, they're authentic, even though their policies are so different.
Right.
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 They're authentic about what they believe in.
Yeah. And they have a sense of, you know, I think public spiritedness, you know, I think that, mm-hmm, was the thing that struck me about Bernie Sanders, was this was a guy who I disagree with on a number of points, not least of which is abortion.
Right.
But at the same time, this is somebody who struck me as genuinely civic minded. This is somebody, mm-hmm, really, you know, it's hokey to say it, but this is a guy who loves his country. Mm-hmm. He is a character out of a Frank Capra movie in a lot of ways, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
and I think people sensed that about him, that he was the real deal. And it's funny, you know, I do get that same vibe from somebody like Ron Paul, who I disagree with even more profoundly on, mm-hmm, a number of things, you know, but I always had the sense that Ron Paul's own fundamental human decency kind of overcame the worst features of his ideology. There was something about him, you know, as a person.
At the very least, both of them come from this consistent place where everything that they say lines up with this underlying philosophy. I mean, granted, yeah, maybe Bernie Sanders' position on abortion doesn't line up with that, unless you...
Well, actually,
the reborn are human. So,
well, I was going to say, actually, coming from the strain of Judaism that he comes from, he is consistent.
Right.
He's not a Catholic. He doesn't have the same view as, you know, a Catholic education would give. And so, yeah, from his perspective, I think he is consistent. I think he's wrong. But
right.
But he's honest, and that's really it. You know. Mm-hmm. There's an honesty there, and yeah, and millennials are looking for honesty. They're looking for people who are not full of BS. Well, we'll be right back after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. We're here today with Michael Litchens and Amy Christine Murphy, and we'll be back talking about Rehumanize International right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hey-o, and welcome back back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Michael Litchens and Amy Christine Murphy of Rehumanize International. And we've been talking about consistent pro-life ethic. You started this group at, Carnegie Mellon?
Yeah, so the club was at Carnegie Mellon, but Rehumanize I founded after I graduated, like 3 months after. Back in 2011.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so you've been, as a millennial yourself, you have naturally given a lot of thought to what millennials are looking for. And you've noticed, along with, you know, every pollster out there is seeing, you know, that your generation is trending away from belonging to political groups, churches. I don't see, there's just kind of not a lot of belief in or interest in party spirits, ideologies, that kind of thing. What do millennials respond to?
Authenticity, consistency, integrity. You know, that's been one of the number one things when we're out doing outreach. People presume, of course, that we're like party line pro-lifers at first. And then when we talk about the consistent life ethic, they'll be like, oh, I've never really encountered this before. And, you know, we'll, of course, have a nice, long, good conversation. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it, the thing I usually get from people is, you know, you're really consistent. Like, I can't really disagree with you, but I do. And like, it's openly admitting, though, that they know that they're being inconsistent.
Right.
And the thing that they value so highly, the thing we value so highly is consistency, is this, you know, this high integrity. And I think it has, you know, in large part to do with the figures that we were grown up, that we grew up learning about, like Martin Luther King Jr., like Anne Frank, like Dorothy Day, like Susan B. Anthony, like Gandhi.
Sophie Scholl.
Right.
And Sophie Scholl.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And people who were, you know, many of them, not all of the people that you mentioned, were martyrs. To consistency. Sophie Scholl, Martin Luther King, Gandhi were all killed for their commitment to consistency, to really having integrity. It's interesting that you use the phrase party line pro-lifers and contrasted that to consistent ethic of life pro-life people. In a sane world, those would mean the same thing. But you're right, they don't. A party line pro-lifer is somebody who means a good Republican.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this point in history, have you read Defenders of the Unborn yet?
No.
I'm in the middle of it. But it talks about the history of the pro-life movement.
Now, who is this? Who wrote this?
Oh, goodness.
I can't recall for the life of me.
I don't recall off the top of my head.
Okay, but anyway, go ahead. Talk about this book. I've not heard of it.
So it came out like last year. So it's fairly new. But it talks about the history of both the pro-life and the pro-choice movement. But, of course, like more focus on the pro-life movement, because there have been a lot of books written on the history of the pro-choice movement. Mm-hmm. It talks about how at the beginning, like, you know, right pre-Roe and post-Roe, the pro-life movement was very, very, very heavily Democratic.
And very Catholic.
And very Catholic, yes. Like, very human rights focused, you know, very focused on this idea of the preborn as a member of the human family, deserving of human rights, in the larger context of these democratic social policies and welfare policies and like social safety net and things like that. And it wasn't until the DNC was like, I think we're going to be pro-choice. That then, of course, Phyllis Schlafly, Eagle Forum, like the RNC, whole GOP was like, oh, we're going to capitalize on this.
Yeah.
More or less.
Yeah.
Granted, of course, like I do believe Phyllis Schlafly was, you know, at least very anti-abortion. But right. I think the tying of the pro-life movement to one political party has more or less resulted in the entire pro-life movement being dragged slavishly behind this party,
right,
instead of, you know, having multiple different parties vying for a pro-life vote.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I think that that's true. And unfortunately, you know, one of the things that's happened is, and I don't think it was by accident, the GOP figured out that the pro-life movement could be manipulated, mm-hmm, into pitting the unborn against every good advocated by Democrats. So it became an either or. Right. If I've seen this used constantly in arguments, you know, so a few years ago arguing with people about torture, what I was told was that abortion is the real torture. Who cares what happens to, you know, some hairy terrorist in some prison cell somewhere when the real torture is abortion? As though, you know, the torture is like the opposite of abortion, instead of very obviously on the same moral spectrum. And right, so the reason you don't torture people is for the same reason you don't torture the unborn, you know?
Right, right.
Yeah, and that, you know, that style of ideological thinking, I think has wrought tremendous damage on the, mm-hmm, pro-life movement. Because what it's resulted in has been exactly what your generation sees, which is a pro-life movement that sees no contradiction at all between supporting or, you know, opposing abortion and supporting a self-confessed sex predator, mm-hmm, for president, who won't even say whether or not he himself has personally paid for abortions for his sexual conquests, which, you know, mm-hmm, that should bother us, you know?
Yes.
You know, your generation sees that and says, yeah, screw this, and walks away.
Yep.
You know, I could say that because it's my show, but they do, you know, okay, yeah, they say a lot worse than that, you know, and with good reason. Because it is, it's a ridiculous mm-hmm, inconsistency, and there should be, it should not be happening. And that's why what you do is so important, because you're consistent. Talk about then, because one of the things that sounds like a radical inconsistency to everybody on both sides of the spectrum is the phrase pro-life feminism. Talk about that.
One of my favorite things to talk about.
All right. I kind of figured it would be.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. I've done so many interviews on this because of the Women's March. What a disaster that was for them, honestly. So, you know, I talked about earlier, I was a feminist before I was pro-life. And I'm honestly a feminist. I'm pro-life because I'm a feminist. Like, I see the two as actually like very linked, honestly. Mm-hmm. Because if you understand feminism to be this, you know, support for, you know, life, dignity, and, you know, like moral, social, economic equality of human beings, regardless of sex, I think it would follow then that this equality is not based on some arbitrary circumstance like sex, right?
Right.
So it must be based on something else. And it's probably not based on any of a number of other circumstances, including ability or race or religion or size. You know, there are so many other circumstances that I think are totally irrelevant to the question of equality.
Yeah.
So if we truly do understand and believe in this equality, then doesn't it make sense that this equality also extends to the pre-born human child? Like, the only way that you don't include the pre-born is if they're not human.
Right.
But science obviously has shown us that that is, like, this false. Like, the pre-born are human beings, like, two same species parents reproduce. They become a member of the same exact species.
I had a guy today on my Facebook page talking to a doctor, right? It's saying an embryo is not human. And I'm going, and yet every embryology textbook in the world says that a human embryo is a human embryo. Boy, right. Are those embryologists dumb, right?
Or this guy's reading some freaky sci-fi we don't know about. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Turns out that a human embryo is human.
Yeah, he was talking about an elephant embryo. Who knows? Hey.
You never know. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, I'm sorry. Oh, well, we're up against a break, but when we return, we'll continue. We're talking today with Amy Christine Murphy and Michael Litchens. Amy is from Rehumanize International, and we are talking about a consistent ethic of life. We'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Oh, and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I am your host, Mark Shea, and my voice ultimately prevails over Ludwig van Beethoven every time. And we are here today with Mr. Michael Litchens and Amy Christine Murphy of Rehumanize International. And we were talking before the break, about this desire for consistency among millennials. And this is one of the reasons that millennials... in many ways, I think very healthily they have the healthy thing I think that millennials are doing is they have forsaken ideology. They don't believe it anymore. Ideology being, you know, an all-explaining system of everything. They tend to not buy that, and they see where party spirit has always consistently led, and so they walk away from that. The downside of it has been the rise of what are called the nuns, not the N-U-N-S, but rather the N-O-N-E-S. Those who, what's your, you know, ecclesial affiliation? Well, none. A lot of people take that as an abandonment to atheism, but that's almost never what it actually means. Most people who self-identify as nuns are not atheists, because atheism is itself perceived as a kind of an ideology. It's this sort of rigid, you know, we know for sure that there is no God. And even most atheists are uncomfortable with that, which is why, curiously, according to a recent Pew poll, 20% of self-identified atheists also believe in God.
Interesting.
Then you're not an atheist. No.
You're not an atheist, right?
No, you may not.
All it really means, of course, is that people who are uncomfortable with religious identification also want to keep their options open. It's the same phenomenon that Paul encountered in Athens when he ran into the statue of the unknown God. It's a way of saying, what do we know? We don't know anything. So we're going to just kind of leave things open. And people who are on that road, very often are people who are in fact profoundly seeking God. They're really looking for God because they're really looking for truth. And you see that a lot with millennials. Millennials This is why they resent people who lie to them, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's, I find, a very hopeful thing. So pro-life feminism, you were talking about that before the break.
Mm-hmm. Just go on.
Yes.
Talk about sure. it. Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, so I finished up talking about it's a human being. So therefore it should fall under the category of, you know, those who have equal human rights. Right. It's interesting because I was on this panel two weeks ago at Catholic University of America on pro-life feminism. And the title of it was Why Can't a Feminist Be Pro-Life? And I just like told all my friends, I was like, I didn't write the name of the talk. I didn't write the name of the panel. I'm sorry. Like, that's not what I think, obviously.
I thought, well, when did you stop beating your wife kind of question?
Exactly. But I closed up my opening remarks by saying, you know, if you actually do believe in this human equality that we have, regardless of sex or any other circumstance, the better question is, can you even be pro-choice and feminist? Because what abortion does is it systemically discriminates against the smallest members of our human family, mm-hmm. based on totally nonsensical, you know, metrics.
Right.
So this pro-choice feminism is actually supporting discrimination, and that's contrary to what feminism is, what it was formulated as, what it should be. So I see the entire trend, honestly, of pro-life feminism not only being the future of the pro-life movement, because it's where millennials are headed, mm-hmm. but I also see it as being the future of the feminist movement. Mm-hmm. Because I think, even amongst, you know, your general stereotypical mainstream feminists, I think just millennials in general are beginning to question, why do I believe this thing, mm-hmm. instead of just accepting the party line as truth?
Right. I think this is one of the reasons that the Democrats made such a huge mistake, you know,
truly,
in this latest dumb effort to excommunicate people over a real issue of conscience. I mean, it's not like people who have, and a lot of, you know, Democrats, you know, they're about 20-30% of the Democratic Party is still pro-life. Mm-hmm. And you're taking these people who are with Democrats on, you name it, equal pay for equal work, you know, opposition to unjust war, the environment. Well, you know, not the Democratic, not the Democratic leadership. Certainly not Hillary. But you know, you're more likely to find them in the Democratic Party than you are in the GOP. Mm-hmm. You know, on a whole host of issues, you've got people who are with the Democratic leadership and really, really not with, you know, the party of Donald Trump. And so you take these people who are your allies and you say, I'm going to give you this litmus test on this ridiculous thing that's a huge issue of conscience for you, and then I'm going to kick you out.
Right?
Because we need to win the midterms, you know?
Yeah.
And what better way to do that than alienating, you know, one-fifth to one-third of your base. That's smart.
I can't tell you how many of my friends on Twitter specifically, I mean, weird Catholic Twitter is basically leftist Catholic Twitter, right? It's a strange, weird, wonderful place.
Yeah.
Full of people who love social policies that support the weak and the marginalized. And I'm just thinking to myself, like, DNC, like, what are you doing? You're alienating all of these people who would generally stand with you. And
Yeah, I know. It's just absolutely crazy. Yeah. Yeah. Because there really still is that very strong tradition, as much as they've blown it with abortion, but there still is this very strong tradition of people who stand for the marginalized and those who stand for doing everything you can to let's build a wall. You know, we'll make Mexico pay for it. And let's drive people out of the country that are desperate refugees and all the rest of this. You know, there are an awful lot of Catholic Democrats who look at that with horror and say, I can't support that. And, you know, they're all ready to be, you know, on the side of the Democrats on all of this. But the Democrats decided that this is a really good time to institute this stupid litmus test. Abortion of all things.
They had their chance.
Yeah.
I think a lot of young people are feeling very Dorothy Day about this. Very, you know, all of this awfulness stems from our acceptance of the filthy, rotten system.
Yeah.
That's where I see things going if they continue in this way.
This is why what you're doing is so important, because although a lot of millennials are still very suspicious of it, at the same time, you have a figure like Pope Francis, who is, I think, my impression is that he's enormously attractive to millennials. Am I wrong?
I don't think so. I would say, generally speaking, especially my everyday friends and not like the most intense of pro-life activists who are entrenched in the movement, but like my everyday friends love the guy.
Yeah.
I think it's great. They understand how authentic of a human being he is, you know?
Right. Yeah. He's the real deal. And that's, you know, part of the, what's important about the work that you do is that it's so vital, I think, for people to learn how to evaluate the world through the lens of a really authentic Catholic tradition like Francis represents, rather than just, you know, well, if my political culture war enemy thinks it, then I'm going to be again at whatever it is. Because then you get, you know, you do get this consistent life ethic, you know, and that's what he exemplifies and that's what you exemplify. And I'm so glad you're doing what you're doing.
Thank you so much. Where can people
find you out on the web?
It is rehumanizeintl.org. You can also find us on Facebook. You can also do lifemattersjournal.org. That still works too.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. And are there ways that people can get involved and can support what you're doing?
Absolutely. I mean, we're always looking for volunteers, you know, friends to do events with us and things of that nature. But we also are sorely underfunded, like all of the best organizations are. So if anyone wants to donate, we definitely would appreciate that. We're a 501c3, so it's tax deductible.
All right. Well, and, you know, and deductions from taxes are what it's all about. All right. Well, I want to thank you so much, Amy Christine Murphy of Rehumanize International, for being on the show today. I want to thank you, Michael Litchens, as well. Our producer today was Danny Head, and he will continue to be our producer tomorrow, too, when we're back with Rod Bennett. Until then, have a grand evening. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.